This is the show your pastor warned you about.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel, your host here today. I'm Stand to Reason. And thank you for joining me for our broadcast. And I look forward to having some of you join me more aggressively as we talk together. 1-800-227-5278. And if you're kind of right around my neighborhood in the 714 area code, 754-4150 is the local number. Of course, this is the marketplace of ideas where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed here in the public forum of talk radio. And this is what I'm looking forward to with you today, give you a piece of my mind, you give me a piece of yours. Incidentally, the enforcer just reminded me this is the first show of our 18th year, and we thank you, all of those who congratulated us last week and then with emails and whatever about completing our 17 years on the air. Thank you. And now as we start the 18th year, I want to kick off by talking about two real important things that have to do with the enterprise that we are engaged in, and that is the issue of clarity and the issue of truth. Now, at Stand to Reason, our goal is to stand to reason, that is to think carefully and clearly about the most important things. But in order to do that well and effectively, we have to be careful to be clear on a couple of different notions, at least in certain areas. And as a kind of a springboard to this conversation, earlier this morning I had a conversation with a dear friend who was LDS, is LDS, Mormon. And obviously, there are some differences of opinion. How much difference is part of what the conversation was about. And I want to talk a little bit about that conversation in the as a springboard to talk about some more foundational issues about how we address these kinds of questions. The questions of ultimate truth, the idea of God and the afterlife and sin and salvation and all of these things that really have eternal consequences. And a couple of weeks, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, we had a conversation here about a comment I heard that someone made who was teaching with regards to Islam, and he made the statement that the God of the Muslims is the same God as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that is the God that we worship as Christians. And the reason that he said that this was the same God is because the Muslims say it's the same God. And one of the points that I mentioned at that time was the absolute critical nature of clarity on these kinds of claims. Just to say that it's the same God doesn't mean it is. We have to look at the particulars. And sometimes there are particulars that are different that seem to be inconsequential. But in the case of Islam, the particulars that were different were not inconsequential. They were foundational. I mean, some person might say, well, we believe in the same Jesus that you believe in, but he was just born in Nazareth and not in Bethlehem. And we think he was born in Bethlehem. Well, I think that's a fairly inconsequential difference. But if it turns out the Jesus that they describe is not the incarnate Son of God, but that if you claim that Jesus is the Son of God in that sense, you're guilty of the most heinous crime and sin of your religion, that would be the sin of shirk in Islam, then I think it ought to be clear to everyone in discussion that even though both parties are referring to someone with the same name, Jesus, that they're really talking about someone entirely different. And by the way, Paul acknowledged this himself. He said in 2 Corinthians, he warned the Corinthians that there were other Jesuses out there. And he didn't mean that there were other people with the name Yeshua. He meant that there were other representations of the one who is central to the Christian faith, Jesus. There were other people who had different characterizations later on in the second century. There was the Jesus of the Gnostics. This was a Jesus who wasn't really human. He just appeared to be human. The Greek word for appear is doser, and therefore they were docetics. They thought that Jesus appeared human, but he wasn't real. He wasn't really human. He didn't take on a genuine human body. So this is a different, completely different understanding of Jesus. That's the Gnostic understanding. You have the Arian understanding, which is where Arius said there was a time when the Word was not. That is, the Word, who later became incarnate in Jesus, was a created being according to Arianism. Now, do you folks see that a Jesus who is a mere finite created being is a different Jesus than the Jesus who is the eternal and ever-existing and never-created second person of the Trinity, the Word, which became incarnate? Do you see that there's a difference? I'm not arguing the merits here. I'm not saying that the classical Christian doctrine here is the true doctrine and the Arians were wrong. The point is they had a different Jesus, which is why they campaigned for their view against our view, a campaign that was finally settled, at least officially, at the Council of Nicaea 325. They were all in the Christian mix, as it were, but there was a powerful internal battle over the details, which details were not about how many angels were dancing on the head of a pin, but were about the very nature of that person named Jesus himself. And for that fourth century, there was a lot of discussion about Jesus. Later on, the Council of Ephesus, you have the Chalcedonian kind of creed and the additions there, all of this about trying to clarify who Jesus was. So historically, the particulars about Jesus and who he was mattered, and it wasn't just enough that a person believed in Jesus in some fashion. It were the particulars. Now, I mentioned that what I'm concerned about here is clarity. In this discussion, the bulk of the discussion, as far as I was concerned with this warning, was trying to get clear on just this particular point. Because part of the claim here from my LDS friend was that we basically have the same religious view. And if you believe this, of course, you're not going to look more closely at the distinctions and the differences, because the differences are somewhat inconsequential. At least that's what is said at one point, but then something else is said at another point. At some other point, you hear a knock at your door and two nice gentlemen with white shirts and black slacks riding bicycles want to have a conversation with you. And it may be that you're a faithful member of the Baptist Church or the Presbyterian Church or the Foursquare Church or the Community Church, whatever. That's not enough. There is an attempt to convert, to share the truth. It's gracious. It's well-meaning. But notice the nature of the engagement. We believe something you don't believe, and you need to change to conform yourselves to the truth. Now, that can't take place if both parties are essentially believing the same thing. And in this case, it was precisely why Mormonism began when Joseph Smith was in Palmyra, New York, and he asked God to show him which denomination to join. A wrong question, by the way, but anyway, this is the way it allegedly happened. God communicated to him that all of the what would be considered now to be Orthodox, legitimate Christian denominations in Palmyra, New York at that time, all of these were abominations. And it was up to Joseph Smith to restore the gospel that had been lost and the priesthood that had been lost. And this is why LDS are called Latter-day Saints. I'm not a Latter-day Saint. I'm not a saint at all. I'm not in the right system. I'm not in the restored gospel system. I'm holding to a system that reflects the lost gospel, or a perversion of the gospel, where LDS holds the restoration. Now, again, I'm not arguing the merits. I'm not saying I'm right, they're wrong. Maybe they're right for the sake of discussion. That's a different discussion. I just want to be clear on the nature of the discussion. We have two different religious views here. They are different at their core. And it does not serve either party not to be completely candid about that particular point. My feelings are not hurt if anyone tells me that my beliefs are wrong. It doesn't bother me in the least. Why should it? It may be that my beliefs are wrong. I guarantee you some are. I just don't know which the wrong ones are. But I pay attention to the ideas and to the reasons. And so if I have someone that believes in Jesus and I believe in Jesus, but it's clear that they are describing essentially a different kind of being, then we can't be believing in the same ones. And this matters. This difference matters. Who do men say that I am? Who do you say that I am? This was a question Jesus himself asked because it was an important question. And if you get that question wrong, it matters eternally. Is Jesus the uncreated God who took on human flesh? Or is he the spirit brother of Lucifer and the spirit brother of all of us? On the Mormon view, Jesus and Lucifer and you and I are all essentially the same kind of creature. In classical Christianity, Jesus is the incarnation of the eternal Word. He is divine to his core, and there is no confusion about what Christians mean by this when you read both especially the creed that came out of Nicaea, which was written for the purpose of being very careful about this point, to stand against the claim of Arius that there was a time when the Word was not. Jesus is uncreated, and he created everything else, according to the Christian doctrine that's classically held. Satan is a fallen angel. An angel is a different kind of being than the eternal Word, and angels are not humans. The book of Hebrews says early on that Jesus is higher than angels, therefore he isn't an angel. He is different than Satan. He's a different order of being. The scriptures also say that though human beings are for a little while lower than angels in terms of the hierarchy, they are higher than angels and will rule over angels in the future. Angels are sexless, according to the teaching of Jesus. Human beings are sexual. Therefore, they're not the same beings. So here we have a core difference. On the area of being, angels, Lucifer, and Jesus, and humans are the same, all offspring of the Eternal Father. In classical Christianity, they are three different groups, and Jesus is God forever. This is a big difference. It doesn't help the discussion if we deny this. And indeed, this is why LDS are a missionary religion even among Christians, because the differences matter, and that should be owned up from the beginning as a matter of intellectual honesty. The second issue is, how do we decide who's right? Let's just be honest and say there are big differences. And in fact, and I've studied this at length, when it comes to LDS, virtually every single point of the discussion, there are significant differences in the gospel, in the person of Jesus, in the person of God, in the nature of creation, in the nature of the priesthood, in the nature of the Holy Spirit. All of these, there are significant differences. Again, I'm not saying who's right here. I'm saying you can only come to any reasonable conclusion about who is right, which justifies any missionary endeavor from either side, if you admit that there are these differences. Then the question is, how do you find out who's correct? I'll tell you one way you don't find out. You don't find out who's correct by looking at the individual person's psychological state. So you don't say, I'm right, and I'm right because you're not interested in the truth. I'm right, and I'm right because you've been brainwashed. I'm right, and I'm right because you don't have enough faith. None of these things have anything to do with truth. They might have a lot to do why people believe what they believe, but it might be that someone is brainwashed, and it might be that they don't have enough faith, and it might be that they aren't seeking after the truth, but this doesn't tell you anything about whether what they happen to hold to be true is true. These are all attacks at the individual. The only way you can find out what's true is by looking at the claims themselves. And when it comes to the Bible is written in words, and God communicated to us in words, and we are to compare the words. We are not to read words and ask God to give us a feeling about whether or not they're true. We're to assess those. Study to show yourself approved, a workman who does not need to be ashamed, handling accurately the Word of God. 2 Timothy chapter 2. In other words, the way to find out the nature of the truth according to God's own Word is to look at God's own Word. Nowhere in the Scripture are we asked to read anything that purports to be from God and then to take counsel with how we feel about it and what we think God is telling us about it. We aren't to ask God whether he would give us a burning in our heart. That is not the directions that he gave us himself from the Scriptures to find out truth. He gave us the truth in propositional claims, and he warned us of adversaries and those who would bring a different gospel, Galatians chapter 1. He warned us of angels of light, Galatians 1 and also 2 Corinthians. He warned us of all kinds of different things, and the direction is always back to the revealed word. So this dispute between anyone who holds to the biblical record, whether it's LDS, whether it's Jehovah's Witnesses, whether it's Christian Science, whether it's those who hold a more classical Christian view. Again, not arguing on the merits, but the way the issue must be resolved is from the text, from that which God has revealed to protect us. He has given his word for protection. We match the old words to the new words and see if they fit. We don't take the new words and ask God to tell us it through a feeling, whether they're right or not. It's the wrong method. And lots of people with all kinds of different religious beliefs get taken down the wrong path because they do something like that. That is, they follow a methodology that is not one that God has given, but is one that that is actually quite popular now. Follow your heart. This does not tell you the truth, and it's a recipe for disaster. I'm not saying the heart has no place. I'm simply saying that it is not the final. It is not the final arbiter. It is too hard, frankly, for the heart to be influenced by other things, isn't it? The question of brainwashing comes up. Can there be an influence of one's family and community? Of course. Can it distort what one reads? Absolutely. It can happen on both sides of the aisle. That's the point. Communities can be constructed as such to keep people from any adverse point of view. That isn't Christianity, by the way. Christianity lays its claims out there in the marketplace of ideas and says, let the best idea win. But it certainly can be the case that somebody is cloistered away in a community of people who believe the same way, and such community can influence, even subtly, our convictions. And that's why if our commitment is to the truth, we are consciously aware of the influence of those environmental factors on our emotions, and we are vigilant to look at the facts to see whether they match up. And if we have a prior commitment to the authority of the Scripture, which every group that I just mentioned does, then that should be our starting point. We don't start with some new revelation and interpret the old revelation and start in light of that new. It's just the other way around, which, by the way, is why I'm a follower of Jesus Christ in the classical Christian notion, not as a Jehovah's Witness or not as in the tradition of Mormonism or Christian Science, because the notions of Jesus are very different at each of one of those. And as I've gone back to the text itself, I've drawn the conclusion that classical Christianity has the most accurate representation. Jesus is not a created being. There's no room in the Scripture for such a thing. So now I am arguing the merits, but I say one comment on the merits to that question. John chapter 1, verse 3, all things, here speaking of the Word, who became incarnate, who became incarnate in Jesus, all things came into being through him, and apart from him nothing came into being that has come into being. John says the same thing two ways, so there's no confusion. I added the extra nothing in there for your emphasis, but that's what he means. Nothing, 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 nothing. The Word is the uncreated Creator. He is an eternal being. He never was created. This is crystal clear in John's writings. So if you teach that Jesus is created, maybe you're right, but I don't think you agree with Jesus. You certainly don't agree with classical Christianity. And before we know what's really true, we better at least admit that we're not talking about the same thing. And then bring our best thinking to bear on the question of who is actually right. 1-800-227-5278. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. I'll be back in just a moment.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org. We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
All right, that's a wake-up call. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host, with you every Sunday, 3 until 5. And I guess we should just jump right into it, huh? What do you think? I was talking a little bit long here at the beginning. So let's get to the calls, and let's talk with Kevin in Barneyville, Alberta. That would be Canada, right, Kevin?
Yes, actually, it's Barneyville, but yes.
Didn't I say Barneyville?
I think you did.
Okay. Barneyville. Okay, great.
Well, first of all, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome, Kevin.
I have two questions for you. I think the first one is that I'm debating an atheist, and I bring up sources, and then he says to me my sources, because they are not refereed, are not worth the paper that they're written on. He says that anybody can write a book on anything. That doesn't mean that it's true.
Well, that certainly is true. I mean, as far as it goes, but what... Okay, so then what is the legitimate requirements for anything to believe to be so to be believed to be so according to this atheist? Your atheist friend believes all kinds of things that a whole group of people didn't jury. I guarantee you.
Yes.
He doesn't believe it. If his requirement is you have no right, you are not justified in believing anything unless a whole bunch of scholars agree or jury it, or I'm not exactly sure what he has in mind, well, then he's completely out of touch with the what is a legitimate justification. And in fact, his own criterion will not justify most of what he believes himself. I mean, look at if I asked him, Kevin, if you asked him this question, do you know what you're thinking right now? What do you think he'd say?
I'm not sure.
Well, my suspicion is he'd say, yeah, I know what I'm thinking.
Right, yes.
Okay, my response is, how do you know what he's thinking? Have you had a number of other people kind of confirm for you the legitimacy, the accuracy of your own awareness of your own thoughts? Well, it's a silly question because no one else has access to our thoughts that other than we do, and we have the kind of access that doesn't really allow much distortion. In other words, if I'm thinking of a pink elephant, I'm pretty sure that I'm accurate. If I think I'm thinking of it, I probably am.
Correct.
And I don't need somebody else to tell me. Now, this is a way of knowing. It's called direct awareness. All right? We have direct access to our own thoughts, and we know our thoughts through direct awareness. Okay? So I don't need a jury there. I don't need a jury to tell me that there are no square circles, all right? Because I have a faculty of rationality that informs me immediately through what's called rational intuition that such things can't exist. So now we have another means of knowing something. No jury involved there. If I had a million professors tell me that square circles were possible, I wouldn't believe a single one of them. Because I have enough common sense to understand the notions and to see that, given a proper understanding of the notions, these things are incompatible. So I use those two things as an example, Kevin, because some people want to disqualify a whole bunch of claims about things in a very arbitrary fashion. They want to disqualify them because they don't match this particular criterion for knowledge, when in fact that particular criterion for knowledge wouldn't allow you to know hardly anything. By the way, let's just say you have five people that are jurying things, right?
Okay.
Why should we trust any of their individual opinions unless we had five other people jury each one of those people's individual opinions? So John Doe says, well, I believe this. Well, why should I believe that unless I have a jury of five others that say yes? But so every jury member can be excluded by that same criterion. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes, and they can go on for infinity.
Of course. Now, if any particular jury member can have a reasonable point of view about something, why can't you without having another jury? I'm not saying that additional opinions aren't useful here, but he's making it a requirement. And what does he make? So you see that problem right off, I hope.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Did you ask him what he had for breakfast that morning? And then how does he know that? Well, I was there. Well, I want a signed affidavit from 10 other people that witnessed this, or else, you know, or, and you need one for you to know it. I need it for me to know it, and you need it for you to know it on your criteria. No, that's silly.
Okay. How about if we go down this path then? Say it's for, we were talking about the archaeology of the Bible.
Okay.
And we're also talking about intelligent design.
Okay.
So those areas, you know, scientific in nature, it is, I would say, common, normal to have them peer reviewed.
No, that I agree with that to a point. Okay. You're taking a walk down the beach. Okay, and the water's lapping on the shore, and there you see in the wet sand you see footprints. Would it be proper? Now this is a physical event. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so in principle, it's accessible for scientific analysis and all of that. But would it be necessary for you to require the analysis of scientists of those footprints before you were justified in concluding that someone had walked across the wet sand?
No, of course not.
No, it's because the nature of the evidence itself is so compelling that you don't need all of this extra stuff, all right? In the case of intelligent design, in principle, it seems, it may be the case. Look, you might need different people to attest to the facts of the matter to make sure that nobody's twisting the truth. But once we get to the facts of the matter, sometimes mere reflection on the facts can deliver a very powerful and legitimate conclusion. The facts of the matter is the triple helix, or the double helix of the DNA molecule, has encoded on it a language in which describes how to build other things. And nobody disputes that. What does that tell us? What does the existence of a language tell us? You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that language is something that comes from mind. It doesn't happen by accident. You can't get intelligible commands by accident, certainly not complex ones. And so even if 100 people told me that this information on this sheet of paper here was produced totally at random, I'm not going to believe them. Because the evidence looking at me in the face is contrary to what they say is the case.
Okay.
Does that make sense? It's just like the person walking down the street. Now, if somebody could show me, no, you know, that looks like a footprint, but let me give you the inside scoop. Somebody did this and that, or the birds, we saw the birds pecking there, and I watched it form into what looked like footprints, so there's no intelligence there at all. Well, then I have to ascertain whether the guy was lying or not, and maybe look more closely at it. And then I might see, oh, there are bird footprints around this, and these are actually a whole bunch of little pecks. But if I looked at it and there were no evidence of pecking or bird footprints, then I probably wouldn't believe the guy. Do you see how the process is working here? I guess the point, some of these things are hard to work out, understandably, but I think that your atheist friend is making an unreasonable demand in the way things are justified as true. And you can't just count up experts, because Einstein was in a minority when he started, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And that's true of a lot. Now, it doesn't mean the minority is always right, the majority is always wrong. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that if your demands, a person's demands, have to be reasonable demands with regards to the knowledge project. Okay? So in the intelligent design, the arguments are that intelligent agents leave behind evidence of their actions, and this evidence could be deciphered, if you will. And I use the illustration of the footprints in the sand. That could be deciphered. And that's what's going on here. Now, are there people who disagree about intelligent design? Absolutely. But you have to look at the reasons why. And I think it would be fair if your atheist friend was even-handed to say, well, you know what, there are some bigger issues that are at stake here. And it might be that one side is being influenced by those bigger issues. Now, of course, he believes that, and he thinks the bigger issues are the existence of God. God doesn't exist. You want to believe he does, and so you're going to tweak the evidence. But isn't it at least fair to say that maybe the other side has a stake in this as well? And that some people are denying the evidence of intelligent design because they don't want God to exist? I mean, this is absolutely obvious. That's why it's important to look at the evidence carefully. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
What was the other question you had?
The question, I was listening to a radio show, and an atheist who called himself a Christian but obviously was not came on, and we were discussing, and so I called him up, and what he was saying, he said that which of the Ten Commandments do I believe in, which version in the Bible? And I didn't know that there were more than
one version. Well, you have the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. You have these commands that are given, and then later on in Deuteronomy, you have the same thing repeated. It might be some of the wordings is a little bit different, but the commands are essentially the same. That the wording is different is irrelevant, because the commands are first given in Exodus, and then in Deuteronomy, 40 years later, Moses is just repeating the substance of it. Okay, and if he adds another one, then that's not a problem. He doesn't, but if he did, it's not a problem. God is free to give more. In fact, there aren't just 10 commandments in the law. There are something like 300 and some, or maybe 600 and some. There are hundreds of commandments in the law. We have just chosen to isolate these in a particular and peculiar way and call them the 10 commandments because of their unique way of being given. But there are a lot more commandments than those in the scriptures. Love one another is a commandment of the scripture, but it's not in the 10. So that we might find other commandments elsewhere doesn't create any problems, I think, for us. What's the significance of the fact that, in his mind, there might be some different wording in different parts of the passages? What is the significance there?
He called it a contradiction.
It's not a contradiction unless it says the opposite. If one place says, thou shalt not murder, and the other place says, thou shalt murder, then you have a contradiction. In other words, a saying that is the opposite of the other. Contradiction.
I agree, and I think he also went to the credibility of the writers that you call it. They say one thing here, then they say another thing over here.
If this is all that takes, that all that's required to sway him, then he is looking for an opportunity to disqualify something, even if there's just, like I said, in different ways of putting. Look, if I asked you to give me the Ten Commandments today, you do the best you could to recite them from memory. And if you got them all, you probably wouldn't get them word for word the way they are in Exodus 21, would you?
No, I would not.
But they could still be the Ten Commandments, right?
Yeah.
You might say you shouldn't steal rather than thou shalt not or whatever. But so you got them. The fact that they are articulated in different words in another place than in the first place, it doesn't matter, because we're not talking about giving Memorex here. It wasn't intended to be that. It was intended to be a summation in Deuteronomy and reminding the Jews of what had been revealed 40 years before. And that's what Deuteronomy is, Deuteronomos, the second law. That's the purpose of it. Moses is dying. The people are going into the land. He's reaffirming for them the contract that they had made with God 40 years earlier at Sinai. I mean, I don't, even if it is different wording, I don't think there are 11 in one characterization and 9 in the other and 10 in another. They're the same, just at different wordings. Roman Catholics and Protestants number them differently because they put different numbers in front of them, but that's our fault, not the Bible's fault. The text is what it is. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, some things are absolutely inconsequential, and I don't see how this is consequential. Am I missing something?
Nope. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah. So let's call them 11. Let's call them 12. There are actually hundreds of commandments in the Old Testament. So what list is which? They're all right. Wherever God makes a command, it's a real command. That's the rule. If he says, here are 10, and the next place says, now here are 10 different ones, fine, they both count. And let's call the first one the Ten Commandments. We'll call the next ones, then we'll call the next set the second, the 20 Commandments. I don't know. You know, this is a silly objection. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call from Barneyville, Alberta. And let's see, time-wise, go to break? Shall I go to break right now? Okay. That was a short segment, but we'll come back for a longer one. We'll talk to Rooney in Columbia, South Carolina, and we got more calls coming up here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
The dictionary defines the word expand this way: a verb, to open up, to unfold, to increase the extent, number, volume, or scope of. Stand to Reason's focus in 2007 is expanding horizons, a goal born out of our desire to increase your understanding of what it means to be Christ's ambassador and to open up the riches of truth in new ways and explore new ways to be more effective as an ambassador for Christ. No conference is better at doing that than our annual Master Series in Christian Thought. This year's lineup of speakers will challenge you to expand your horizons as you face the pressures of being a Christian in today's world. These extraordinary minds will broaden and deepen your understanding of truth amidst an antagonistic and divisive culture. Never has the need been greater for Christians who confidently and competently defend what they believe. You can order the lectures individually, or even better, you can benefit from the entire series. Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. James Emery White, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, and our own Greg Kokel and Alan Schliemann. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON to order this series that will expand your horizons.
I'm Henry the Eighth, I am. Henry the Eighth, I am, I am. I got married to the widow next door. She's been married 7 times before. And everyone was an Henry.
Greg Kokel back with you here, Stand to Reason. Careful, intelligent discussion about ethics, values, and religion with you every Sunday. And if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, 1-800-227-5278. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Rooney. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Greg?
Good, Rooney. How are you?
I'm all right. Hey, I got a situation for you.
Okay.
I'm a boss where I work at. It's pretty close-knit work environment, and I got a few people underneath me, and when I took the job, they were listening to music in the work area which I found offensive.
Okay.
It was like a hip-hop, R&B radio station, and, you know, you pretty much know how that...
Yeah, sure. Station. By the way, did you say you're the boss?
Yeah, I'm the boss.
Are you the employer? Are you the owner of the company, or are you the manager?
To be more specific... I'm an officer in the military.
I see.
And I have a little section where when I'm in charge.
So I got you. Okay.
The boss, but, you know.
Okay.
So basically, I told him that the music was offensive to me, and then I, you know, it was against my religious, you know, views, and that I would just ask for it to be, you know, to be turned off.
Right.
I didn't want to subject them to, you know, my music, just because they didn't want to listen. I mean, I didn't want to listen to their music.
Right.
A little later on, someone of my same rank, you know, just I guess like a friend of mine, also a Christian. I think the word got around that I didn't like let anyone in my section listen to their music.
Sure.
So he came to me and he said, "Well, that a lot of times what we do when we do things like that, meaning what I did, really hurts the body of Christ, you know, more than it helps them because now I've turned them off to Christianity." And I was just wondering, what was your take? What is the principle there when we approach?
Right. Well, I'm glad you called, Rooney. And I guess the simple answer is I think that I side with your friend in this one, but that there's actually a couple of different things going on here that I'll mention. Let me try to lay it out in principle here, and then we'll apply it in the specific to your circumstance. If you are the employer, which you're not in this circumstance, but though you are the boss, you're the manager. But if you are the employer, if a person is an employer over a company, and he doesn't like the music, he can do whatever he wants because it's his company, and employees aren't there to express themselves and to experience their rights. Their employees are there to work and to make a living and to fulfill the behests of the employer and therefore get a paycheck, okay? And if the employer doesn't like certain things in his environment, that's up to him because he's the boss and he can run the job. That's okay. That's the first thing. So an employer situation, I think employers ought to be able to call the shot. Now, you're a manager, and the nature of your complaint, though, was not as a manager. You pulled rank it maybe, but the nature of your complaint was, if I understood it, is not that this is not good for the work environment, and as a manager, I am stopping this because it's not good for everybody, but rather you said it's not good for me. I don't like it. It's not consistent with my views. It's offensive to me given my religious views, and therefore I don't want you to do this. In other words, what you were doing is you were demanding that these other people live in a way that's consistent with your conscience. Now, I think that's a big mistake. It's not just a mistake, in a sense, tactically for you as a Christian, which is the point that your friend brought up, but I think it's a mistake of anyone. This is what happens a lot. I don't like what you're doing in the community, and therefore I'm offended, therefore you shouldn't do what you're doing. By the way, this is usually done by non-Christians to Christians. I don't like you talking about God. I don't like your Christian music. I don't like... If you're praying a prayer for a prayer breakfast with a lot of different faiths, you can't say in Jesus' name, amen, because there are people here who don't believe in Jesus, and therefore you have to pray according to their conscience instead of according to yours. I never like this because I don't think this is tolerance. I think this is really intolerance. It's to demand that other people live in a way that's consistent with our own sensibilities.
But Greg, you know, I didn't tell them to listen to, you know, gospel music or Christian music.
But
I just said that we just not listen to any music.
See, that's what ends up happening. Then unless we can find something that everybody feels good about, then nobody can have anything. I actually don't think as a citizen, I'm not talking as a Christian right now, but just as a citizen, I don't think this is the right way to approach our community. I think it's good that any individual voluntarily try to be careful about other people's sensitivities, all right? So we should be considerate of other people. And so if there is something that I'm doing that just drives the guy next to me crazy, just out of basic consideration and being a good neighbor and those kind of ethics, then I should try to change it. I should take consideration. But for someone to demand, I don't like that music, you turn it off. Because it's not consistent with my beliefs, that's a good reason for you not to listen to it. It's not a good reason for them not to listen to it. Okay, so I think there is a place, if you're deeply offended, for you to share that by way of letting people know that this troubles you. But to make the demand that everybody conform to your ideas, I don't think is a good one. And partly I'm saying this, it's not good for anybody to be that way. I don't think somebody should say, you know, I don't like the smell of smoke, therefore you shouldn't be able to smoke in my presence. I don't like the sound of that music, therefore we should, nobody plays any music. I don't like your cross on your desk, so nobody puts any crosses on any desk or any religious things. To me, this is not a healthy way of living in community with other people. That's a separate issue. Go ahead.
How do we take a stand then? Us being Christians in the secular environment.
Yes.
How do we take a stand for Christ?
No, that's a very important question, and I'm glad that you asked it. If you go to 1 Corinthians 5, Paul makes a statement there, and he says, we are not to judge non-believers. We are to judge those who are believers. And the point there is that we are not to demand that other people act in a way that is consistent. We aren't to demand that other people live like Christians when they're not. Now, there are some limitations to this I'll mention in just a moment, but in general, we're not to demand that. If you think of the demand or what you said to the other people there, Rooney, you weren't making a statement for truth. You were saying, I don't like that, I don't agree with it, turn it off. And that's a different thing entirely. Now, if you have somebody promoting abortion and children are being killed as a result of it, then we make a stand there to save the lives of other children, not to increase our own comfort level. Do you see the difference there?
Mm-hmm.
When we have same-sex marriage being promoted in culture, this is dangerous to culture, on my view at least. And that's why on that issue I can't have a live and let live point of view. If somebody wants to listen to rap, though, I mean, I don't think that's a big enough issue for me to make a fuss about it, and especially when the biggest issue is I'm annoyed by it. In that case, I think your friend is right that sometimes we pick at smaller issues that get in the way of people being able to hear the important things that we have to say. Does that make sense?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I think my biggest concern also is, I mean, I have another concern, which is, I mean, also my well-being as well. I mean, I come from before I was a saved, you know, I listened to that kind of music. So it's kind of, I guess it's my Achilles heel, in a manner of speaking.
That does make it a little different. But even in that case, I think what would have been better is to go to these individuals, you know, shoulder to shoulder, not with any rank, but just saying man to man, person to person, human being to human being, you know, I know you really like that stuff, and that's your business, but I came from a background where this and that, and this is really hard for me to listen to that, and I just wondered if maybe when I'm here you could listen to something else or nothing at all. But that's a request that you're making of them and that they respond out of their goodwill. I don't think it's a legitimate demand that you make as a superior officer, my view. It's the same kind of thing. Look, if they want to put up pornography in their booth or whatever, fine. But you could say, you know what, I'm a married man. And that stuff gets my mind thinking about things that I shouldn't do. Now, if you want to put it in your magazine and read it on the slide, that's your business, and I'm not going to judge you for doing that. But it would make it easier on me if you didn't hang it on the wall for the reasons that you gave them. Do you see how that's different?
Yeah, I do. Even though the line here is still kind of, you know, it's a very thin line because, of course, I'm the person who grazed them.
Well, see, this is another issue. Now, if you're talking about, but this isn't how you address the issue. If what you're talking about, what is good in the workplace? I'm the manager of the workplace. It doesn't matter what my personal beliefs about religion are. What's good for us working together as a team? That music is blaring really loud, and it's distracting from the rest of us working, so we're going to turn it off. If you want to put on Mantovani or Frank Sinatra, you can do that. If you don't like him, then nothing. But that's distracting to everybody, and it doesn't help the work product. That's a different kind of complaint than what you raised. So you have to assess not based on your personal religious convictions, but based on what's good in the workplace. Now, if you're working in a bar, you couldn't raise that objection because that's the atmosphere in a bar, you know. But if you're working in a military establishment, then you have to ask what's good for our work product. And then a whole bunch of things may be taken into consideration there. But that's a different rationale than you raised. Fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay, Rooney.
Something to think about. Thanks.
Yeah, please do. And it probably wasn't what you were expecting to hear from me, but I do believe in taking a stand. You know that, right?
Right.
Yeah, but we have to take the stand on the right things and in the right way.
All right.
Go to 1 Corinthians 5 and read what Paul has to say about judging non-believers and see if that doesn't help inform your circumstances.
Okay.
Okay, all the best, Rooney.
All right.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to Chicago, which is my kind of town because that's where I was born. You still there, Maureen?
Yes, I am.
Okay, fine. Hold, Melinda, I think I just put Rooney's line on hold, so maybe you can clear that. I'm not sure what's going on there. So, but now I'm talking to Maureen. Welcome to the show. Whoops.
Hello?
Okay, hold that. Can you clear that for me? Sorry, that was my fault. Okay, what happened? We lost Maureen. Pushed the wrong button. Maureen, please call back. My deep apologies for that. I did a boo-boo. Let's go to Guillermo. Guillermo, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Greg.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Awesome.
What's on your mind?
Well, what programs would you recommend majoring on in order to become an effective apologist?
Well, three come to mind quickly. Are you talking about programs? I'm presuming you're talking about in an academic environment. Yeah. Well, the first three that come to mind are theology.
Okay.
So if you're going – an apologist is someone who makes a defense for something. If you're going to be a Christian apologist, you're making a defense for Christianity. So if you're going to defend Christianity, you better be really clear on what it is you're defending. Okay? This relates to my opening comments, actually. You know, if what one thinks about their Christianity is it's basically the same as a whole bunch of other religions – then you're not probably having an accurate understanding of the Christianity that needs defending, all right?
Right.
So there's a theological component, and there's certain foundational truths that are critical, and I consider these the enduring truths of classical Christianity, reflected by the creeds, but more about the consensus of Christianity over the ages. The deity of Christ is an example of one, the Trinity, salvation by the blood atonement of Christ, the authority of the Bible. Things like that.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. There's a theological component. Can't be avoided. Pretty obvious, I think. And by the way, this is a theological component which you need some theological precision. It's not just a general thing, but precision. Second, I think philosophy is really important. And the reason that philosophy is important is because, at least the philosophy I'm talking about, is the tools of philosophy, the skills of philosophy. Philosophy is the ability. Philosophy is a discipline that is dedicated to discovering the nature of reality. And the way it does that is by making refined observations about things and using vocabulary to make distinctions that maybe you didn't make before that gives you a clarity of things. It's like taking the world and bringing it down into focus more clearly. And the language, certain distinctions, like the difference between a substance and a property, between a necessary and a sufficient condition, the difference between, those are two that just come off the top of my head. These are distinctions that are really important in order to parse out particulars that are important in our conversation. And I hope if you're a student of Stand to Reason, you listen to the show, you notice that there, Kokel's making a distinction now that I've never heard before. And that distinction is a good one to make something clear that wasn't clear before. Notice earlier I was talking about LDS. I said, Jesus is one thing, angels are another, and human beings are another. These are three different kinds of beings in the Bible, so therefore they can't all be basically the same thing. There's a distinction. Philosophy helps you to make those distinctions.
Okay.
And it allows you to traffic with people who are more careful about their thinking and that you pick up the habit if you're lucky and you're reading good people. The third thing is apologetics proper, and that is the particular skills that relate, the content that relate to particular challenges on Christianity. So this might be understanding of other religious groups. It might be particular arguments for the historicity of the life of Christ and why we believe that and why we believe in the resurrection, or answering challenges. The problem of evil, for example, challenges like sometimes come down here about contradictions in the Bible, those kinds of things. So those are more specific to the task of defending the truth, either going on the offensive or taking the defensive and dealing with issues. But notice, did you hear my opening remarks today?
No.
Okay, well, if you listen back on this show, which I hope you do, and then you can hear yourself on the radio, on the MP3 file on our website, listen to the opening remarks. And all of my remarks at the opening, almost all of them, except for one right at the end, were about essentially a philosophical approach, a philosophical reflection. How do we know what's true? One way is we got to figure out what the differences between two points of view are and be very, very clear on those, and then ask the question, what kind of evidence would matter in adjudicating between these two questions? That's philosophy. So philosophy, theology, and apologetics proper is what I'd suggest. And we have some great books in all areas over at the Stand to Reason website, so I suggest you go there, Guillermo. Thank you so much for the call. Hour number one is history, and we've got another hour ahead. 1-800-227-5278, room on the lines there. In the 714 area code, 754-4150. And ring us up, and we will chat with you in our second hour of Stand to Reason. This is the second hour of Stand to Reason. It's Greg Kokel, your host here. And it's my pleasure to talk with you about anything dealing with ethics, values, and religion. Of course, that's what we do every week. Thought Radio, I want to know what you think, why you think it. Because thinking matters, not just feeling. What I like to say, friends, is that feelings make life delicious and thinking makes it safe. Careful thinking. I feel so badly about losing Maureen from Chicago. If she doesn't call back shortly, and we do have an 800 line open, Maureen, you can try back here. We'll put you at the head of the class, but I'm going to do my best to deal with your question as I understand it in just a moment. I have something to read that I've been hanging on for a little bit. It's one of those... it's a little bit of advice being passed on here by Paul Harvey, but it does reflect some of my own concerns, and I think it's especially appropriate since yesterday was the memorial for my father-in-law, Ray Melberg, and we all got to say our final goodbyes to Ray, who died 2 weeks ago. And one of the things that was so rich about reflecting on Ray's life yesterday is that it spans such a large amount of time, 95 years. Ray was born a month and a half before the sinking of the Titanic. He built his first airplane in 1936, and there were a number to follow. In any event, he was a pioneer and a hardworking guy, and a guy who wasn't afraid to roll up his sleeves and to get his hands dirty and to work hard and to follow his dream and to get it done on his own and not complain. Never heard him complain. In fact, when my son was changing the engine in his Mustang, 1967 Mustang, which was kind of a beater by the time he inherited it from his mom. They were going to put a new engine in, and one day I showed up, now, and there was Ray standing in the engine compartment. I mean, the engine was out, and the hood was up, and Ray was standing right in there working on something. Now, Ray died when he was 95. I've only known him 10 years, so he was at least 85 when he was doing this. He's probably more like 88. Anyway, he wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty. And I see in this what Paul Harvey writes, kind of an ethic that's being expressed that was certainly characteristic of Ray Melberg's life and to some degree mine and certainly Paul Harvey's and a desire to pass some of those values along. So here's what he writes. He says, "We tried so hard to make things better for our kids, then we made them worse." And here's Paul Harvey's hopes for his grandchildren and my hopes for my children. He writes, "I'd really like you to know about hand-me-down clothes and homemade ice cream and leftover meatloaf sandwiches. I really would. I hope you learn humility by being humiliated and that you learn honesty by being cheated. I hope you learn to make your own bed, mow the lawn, and wash the car. And I really hope nobody gives you a brand new car when you're 16. It'll be good if at least one time you can see puppies born and your old dog put to sleep. I hope you get a black eye for fighting for something you believe in. I'm with you on that one. I hope you have to share a bedroom with your younger brother and sister. And it's all right if you have to draw a line down the middle of the room, but when he wants to crawl under the covers while you're with you because he's scared, I hope you let him. By the way, I didn't have my own room until I was a junior in college. When you want to see a movie and your little brother and sister wants to tag along, I hope you let them. I hope you have to walk uphill to school with your friends and that you live in a town where you can do it safely. On rainy days when you have to catch a ride, I hope you don't ask your driver to drop you two blocks away so you won't be seen riding with someone as uncool as your mom. If you want a slingshot, I hope your dad teaches you how to make one instead of buying one. I hope you learn to dig in the dirt and read books. And when you learn to use computers, I hope you also learn to add and subtract in your head. By the way, Ray Melberg, up until just a year or so ago, used to do crossword puzzle almost every day, and he did it with pen. That's confidence, isn't it? I hope you get teased by your friends when you have your first crush and when you talk back to your mother that you learn what ivory soap tastes like. Now, there's an old-timer writing that. May you skin your knee climbing a mountain, burn your hand on a stove, and stick your tongue on a frozen flagpole. And if a friend offers you dope or a joint, I hope you realize he's not your friend. And I sure hope you make time to sit on porch with grandma or grandpa, go fishing with your uncle. And in this case, it would be your papa. That's me. May you feel sorrow at a funeral and joy during the holidays. These are things, Paul Harvey writes, that I wish for you. Tough times and disappointment, hard work and happiness. To me, it's the only way to appreciate life. Written with a pen, sealed with a kiss, I'm here for you. And if I die before you do, I'll go to heaven and I'll wait for you. And that's what Ray did. Ray Melberg did with us. He's waiting. And Maureen, I'm so glad you called back.
Oh, great.
My apologies. We pushed the wrong buttons and it was really my fault.
No problem. I gave me a chance to eat dinner before I called back.
Well, that was a quick one. That's what you call fast food. What's on your mind, Maureen?
I have a question. I have several friends that I deal with, and I do try to take the approach that you take as far as presenting facts and showing how, you know, two contradictory things can't be true at the same
right.
time. And it doesn't really seem to make any difference. They're still of the opinion that it doesn't matter what the topic is, but, of course, religious things in particular, that it doesn't really matter because, you know, if you feel it, it's true for you. You
mm-hmm.
know? I'm trying to get to the difference between what you feel and what is an actual
mm-hmm.
fact. And they just, I can't get past that point.
Yeah, yeah. This is a very difficult thing to get through, to get past. In fact, I've written about this as a problem of postmodern influence on our culture, that when you talk about truth, people are thinking about a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they feel it a certain way, it's true for them, and that's as far as it goes. Doesn't matter anymore. It's a difficult thing to get through. And the best thing, I've got a couple of responses I'll share with you that might help you, but I can't guarantee anything, because what's going on here is a commitment by people to believe what they're comfortable with, what they like, not to be challenged by things that don't appeal to them. And they have been given permission by a foolish, foolish culture to believe all kinds of nonsense and feel like it's legitimate because it's their own beliefs. And they will suffer greatly in the long run because of this nonsense. It is a very difficult thing to overcome. So I'm just warning you in advance. When they say that something is true for them, ask them, what do you mean by that? That's our second question. That's our first Columbo question, if you recall. What do you mean? What do you mean it's true for you? And they say, well, I believe it. I think it's true. Okay, now I know what you mean. You mean you believe it. So the word truth now is a synonym for belief. Do you see that, Maureen?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so the question is it possible that your beliefs could be mistaken? Yes. Well, I'd ask him that. That would be, a reasonable person would have to say yes. So it's possible that your truth is not actually true. Correct? Now, of course, you're using the true in the second sense in a different way.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to shock him into thinking about this correctly. Is it possible to be mistaken about what you think is true? Yes. Well, then your truth isn't true, is it? And that could hurt you. Well, my truth is true for me. I know you already said that. You mean you believe it. But what if it's true for you that arsenic is an aspirin? Aspirin and arsenic are the same thing. Then you take arsenic. Will it kill you? It won't cure your headache just because you think it's aspirin. It'll kill you, right? And see, this is where I want to get people as best I can to shake them out of this way of thinking that it's true for me and that's the end of it. Now, it may be the end of it in terms of what they're willing to consider, but in terms of legitimacy, it isn't the end of it because they could be mistaken. I ask, is there a difference between believe and make-believe? Is there a difference between fantasy and reality? Have you ever met anybody in denial? These are all questions you can ask them. Have you ever met anybody in denial? When you say that they're in denial, what do you mean to be telling them? Aren't you telling them that they believe one thing, but they're believing something false because it feels good to them? And there is something else that is actually true, contrary to what they believe, and the truth matters? You think you can quit drinking anytime you want. You're in denial. You're an alcoholic. Well, wait a minute. Isn't that true for them? Do you see the direction I'm going with these comments?
Yeah, I have told them that, you know, we don't live that way in the real world, you know.
Right.
And I've told them that, especially some of them, that they have chosen their path and they think that that's true.
Well, if they think it's true...
Oh, correct, I should say.
Yeah, well, correct then is that it's true morally. It is the appropriate path to take. That's one thing. If they think as long as they believe it, it makes it true, that's something different. Atheists think that their view is true, but they don't think it's true like your friends are talking about truth. They think there is no God. And they think you're wrong and they're right. And so they're willing, and in a sense, it's refreshing to argue with an atheist because at least you're still thinking about truth the same way.
Right.
They're not going to say, this is true for me and that's true for you and we got nothing to talk about. They actually think we're wrong. But even people who talk in this postmodern way think they're wrong too. I mean, think you're wrong too.
Oh, they do, which is what I tried to bring up because I've told them they will straight out tell me that the Christianity is false. You know, in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So,
in the objective sense, it's false.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's well. You look at Maureen. You can only do so much, and I think I'd stick with these people, and then just be close to them, so that when their world falls apart, you're there to help them pick up the pieces. And this shows what their world brings them to. This is true for you, right? Look at the mess you're in. Look at what your way of thinking about things have done. See, you disobey God, you go your own way, and this is what happens. So sometimes people, you can only go so far with talking to people. You can pray for them, you can be there, ready. But if people want to continue to believe foolishness, sometimes you are not going to disabuse them of that. And no matter how hard you try, there's no magic bullet here. All right?
Okay.
Maureen, hang in there. I can tell you're in earnest and you care about your friends and you're doing the best you can, and that's really all that the Lord asks of you. The rest is in His hands.
Thank you.
Okay, just steady at the plow. All right? Thank you for the call. Let's go to, it looks like Kalama, Washington, and John. Did I say it right? Is it Kalama?
Kalama.
Kalama. Welcome to Stand to Reason, John.
Thanks. Hey, I understand you're going to be up in this area.
It depends where Kalama is.
No.
In May, I'll be in the Olympia area. Early May, I'll be in the Olympia area in Washington.
I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Well, good. I hope you come. Thank you.
My question is, I've been asked this twice now, and specifically the question is does God test his people? I know that he did it in the Old Testament, or at least there's clear direction. In fact, I was reading in Exodus to where it says God was testing the people to see if they would be obedient to him. But is it now normative for God to be testing his people?
Mm-hmm. When you say normative, I think you mean normal, like ordinary, right?
Yeah, just...
Normative means something different. Normative means prescriptive or you ought. The normative thing, that means the thing that ought to be done. So it's
okay.
A little different. Yeah. But I think the simple answer to that is yes, I see no reason why God wouldn't continue to test his people in a certain fashion. I'm not sure if it's the same motivation. And certainly God doesn't test to learn anything new. He tests in the sense of reproving and challenging and allowing trial to come upon the people. And a lot of times we learn stuff about ourselves in the process. Now the word in the New Testament for test is the same as the word for tempt. And it does say clearly that God does not tempt, if you understand that word to mean, in that circumstance, induce to sin.
Right.
God does not induce us to sin, but he certainly does test us. He allows testing to come upon us, and I don't see any reason why he might not even initiate testing. In 1 Peter, we see a reference to this kind of thing. I'm looking for it now. It talks about a time of testing coming upon. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, verse 12, chapter 4, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. So there, it makes it clear that God uses things for testing. Now here was persecution coming from non-Christians on Christians, okay, which God was using as a test. And notice how he says, don't be surprised as if something strange were happening. No, this kinds of things coming on us for testing is a normal thing. In fact, later on we see challenges in chapter 5, challenges by Satan. And after you have suffered a little, for a little while the God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ will perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. And that's verse 10 of chapter 5. So there you have a sense of God using these testings, which he allows and ordains, for the sake of strengthening and building the Christian for particular purposes. All righty?
All right. Okay.
Now, he doesn't tempt you, but he certainly does allow things to come into our lives to make a radical difference, and sometimes it's hard, but God is with us. There is no temptation or testing that has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tested or tempted beyond what you're able, but with it will also allow a means of escape so that you may be able to endure it.
Okay, well, let me ask this just a little bit.
Very quickly.
He does allow temptation, is that correct?
Of course.
It's not the same to say that he tempts us.
God does not create the inducement. He does allow inducements to happen from other sources. If he didn't allow it, then it wouldn't happen, would it?
Well, I'm asking the same thing about testing. Does he directly do it, or is it that he's allowing it?
I'm not sure. But it doesn't matter. He uses the testing is something in his desire to do. It is not his desire that we sin.
You're right.
He is willing to let us be induced to sin, and that is kind of a test. But there are other testings too that aren't inducements to sin. They are trials that are in which we are allowed. We have the opportunity then to endure through, and this is a way of testing as well.
Interesting.
All righty.
Hey, thanks, Greg.
Sure, gotta go. I appreciate the call, John, and we'll get to your calls after the break. More coming from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Buena Park, California. So all over the map today here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org. We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kochel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kochel.
Well, this goes back. I don't even know what that word means, but it reminds me of high school. Greg Kochel and Stand to Reason here, and this is your opportunity to get the fat out of your thinking, friends. You can trim down to Fight and Weight every Sunday afternoon, 3 to 5. We've got callers here and open lines, 1-800-227-5278. Just a reminder, congratulations to Dwayne Geddes from Buffalo, New York, who is our Frapper winner this week. And I guess we'll be sending – did I already sign that book? Yeah, we're sending you a book. We have chosen your name out of our group of people who've registered on our website. If you go to our website at str.org and then in the lower left-hand corner, you'll see the microphone or is it the podcast, whatever it is, something you punch there and you go to the podcast site, and you can actually register as a member and indicate on the map of the world where you live and let us know that you're part of our listening community, and then your name will go into the pot with the rest of those in that community, and we draw from that once a week and send a free gift. And Dwayne Geddes at Buffalo, New York, you're the recipient, so I hope you enjoy the book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. Let's go to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Ed. Ed, I was just up in your neck of the woods not too long ago.
And I missed you.
Yeah, I think it was the second week of December, and I did a talk in Harrisburg. That's not far from you, is it?
Not far at all.
Yeah, good people out there and good country. I enjoyed it.
I do, too.
Good.
My son has a friend who is a fairly committed atheist. My son is 15,
mm-hmm.
So they do quite a bit of back and forth of debating Christianity versus atheism.
Okay, good.
And,
good for him.
What's that?
Good for him.
I feed him stuff from time to time, too. He comes to me and says, well, he said this. And,
yeah.
He said that. The latest thing was this friend pulled up a formal logic proof of atheism, mm-hmm. by Quentin Smith.
By Quentin Smith. Okay, Quentin Smith is a smart guy. No question about that. But I'd be interested to hear what this is. He's actually done a lot of work with William Lane Craig. They've authored books together. And Bill Craig would be the one to answer this, but I don't know what the formal proof is. Partly what Melinda said when we were anticipating your call is that, you know, if you know, if it were that easy just to come up with a simple formal proof that would annihilate God, then you know, he would have been done away with a long time ago. But keep in mind, and I'm just going to offer this thought here: formal proofs, they first all have to be logically sound, and that is the conclusions have to follow from the premises. There have to be no ambiguities in the words, and the premises have to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get a formal proof that goes through, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've actually never heard any formal proofs for atheism, but I'd like to. The other thing that you have to keep in mind, too, is other evidence. So if it looks like there's a formal proof that proves something, and you have other evidence that's powerful and compelling to the contrary, then it gives us reason to believe that something is wrong with the formal proof, even if we can't see the mistake at the moment. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay, good. What do you got?
Well, he follows he does strictly based on logic, not necessarily based on physical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs through 10 steps.
I can't do all 10 steps here, and I mean, I won't be able to follow it. The rest of the people, can you give me the sense of it?
Sure. The first 5 steps really are just kind of setting up givens. For instance, he talks about omnipotence, where if a being is omnipotent and it wills something to exist, then it will exist.
If that's what he's saying, he's already in trouble. Because omnipotence, now let me just, I've heard arguments like this before, and it's an attack on the God of the Bible. Here's a very simple way. God is all-powerful. Can he make a rock so big he can't lift it? Well, he can't lift something, and therefore he's not all-powerful, he can't make something, therefore he's not all-powerful, the nature of the question itself secures the fact that God can't be all-powerful. But this turns out to be a pseudo question, because there's a mistaken understanding in the way the question is asked. I've answered that whole issue, by the way, on our website. If you just put in the word rock in the search feature, and you'll find it. But omnipotence, remember, omni is all, and potence refers to what?
Power.
Power. That means he has all power. All claims to omnipotence are limited to what power can do. Sometimes there are things that are tasks that are not doable that have nothing to do with the exercise of power. And so a task that is undoable for reasons other than power is not in any wise a limit on omnipotence. Omnipotence has to do with things power can accomplish. Do you see the point I'm making?
Yeah.
I sometimes give this illustration with a group of people. You pick a big, giant, strong guy, right? Give him a paperclip. I say, can you bend that paperclip into a square? Okay, yeah, he bends it. I say, can you bend it into a circle? Yeah, he does his best and bends it into a circle because he's a strong guy, right? All right, now bend it into a square circle. He didn't even try. I said, what's the matter? Aren't you strong enough? You're a big guy. That's just a little piece of wire. Come on. And, of course, the point is that this has nothing to do with power. So if your question is, if the way this is being set up with a given, and given are the parameters of the argument, the given is that what omnipotence amounts to is the ability to do anything that the will wills, then that's a mischaracterization of the omnipotence I'm willing to defend for the God of the Bible. He's talking about some different creature already. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, actually, point 5 kind of summarizes the previous points, and he's not dealing with it quite in that sense.
Okay.
He says, point 5 says, if God exists, God is omnipotent and the cause of the universe that exists. In other words,
God is omnipotent and the cause of the universe that exists. Yes, we hold that to be the case.
Right. And then point 6 is where I believe the major error is. It says, if the universe is willed to exist by God and the universe does not exist, then it is the case that A, God wills the universe to exist and the universe exists, and B, God wills the universe to exist, and the universe does not exist.
Oh, yeah, okay. Now, he's lost me here. If God, well, obviously that can't be true.
Right.
They both can't be true. It's a contradiction.
Right, and that's what he's basing his whole argument on.
But wait, I don't see where he's uttered the contradiction. I don't see the contradiction based in somehow in theism.
Right.
We say that God willed the universe to exist, and it does exist. It's not the case that the universe doesn't exist. We're part of it, so it
right.
does exist, and God willed it to exist. What's the difficulty there?
Well,
I mean, what does he think the difficulty is? I guess I must have missed something here.
Well, that's kind of what I was wondering. I was hoping you might have been familiar with where he came up with this, because you know, this if he willed it to exist and it doesn't exist, where would that come from? It doesn't make any logical sense.
Well,
to me.
If he willed it to exist and it doesn't exist, then he wouldn't be powerful enough to cause it to exist, and therefore he wouldn't be all powerful. Okay, that follows. But the universe does exist. So where are you going to go from here, you know? I guess I'm missing the argument entirely.
Well, that's kind of where I'm thinking his argument is broken.
Well, it doesn't even – I don't even – I'm you and I both must be misunderstanding something. Go ahead and read that point again.
Okay. If the universe is willed to exist by God –
uh-huh.
If the universe does not exist, then it is the case that God wills the universe to exist and the universe exists, and B, God wills the universe to exist and the universe does not exist.
Well, no, that's nonsense. I don't get it at all. Look, here's what I hold. I hold that God willed the universe to exist and it does exist.
Right.
And God, it does exist in virtue of the fact that God is all-powerful and he is capable of doing what he wills to do in any area that has to do with the execution of power. Therefore, there's nothing inconsistent or contradictory about that notion. And so you read it to me twice. I don't make sense out of it either case. Maybe I missed something in the earlier steps that would cause this thing to go through, but... I don't get it. So I'm sorry, Ed in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I'm not going to be able to help you with this one.
Okay.
All righty. By the way, you know the Kalam cosmological argument? Do you know that argument? Everything that came into being had a cause. The universe came into being. Therefore, the universe had a cause.
I think you touched on that last week.
I don't know that I talked about it, but that's...
Nothing exists without a cause?
Well... Oh, yeah, I guess we did touch about – yes, I didn't articulate the argument, but I offered a thought on that. But anyway, that's a good argument that William Lane Craig offers, and this is a very, very strong formal proof for the existence of God. And what you're going to have to argue against that proof is you're going to have to argue that things can come into existence out of nothing. And the universe is one of those things that came out from out of nothing. Now, this is highly implausible. Even if you say it's possible to come in from – is it reasonable to think – maybe this was the point I made last week. Is it reasonable to think it came in from nothing? No. The smart money is on the odds-on favorite, and that is the universe followed the pattern of everything else we know. I was talking about agent causation last time. Yeah, you're right. I did go into this in more detail. But I think that these are reasons to believe in theism, and I don't know if your son's friend wants to take refuge in this arcane proof that's offered by Quentin Smith, and this is where he's going to place his bet. More power to him. All righty?
All right.
Okay, thanks, Ed.
Thanks very much, Greg.
Sure. Bye-bye. Let's go to Buena Park, California, and it looks like Joe.
It's Joe.
Hello, Joe. What do you know?
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
What do I know? That's all right. We get a lot of flack.
Okay, what's on your mind?
I thought about 20 different ways to phrase this issue, but let's try this. How should the church deal with a situation where a relatively mature Christian single man is living with a relatively mature Christian single woman?
Are they just merely cohabiting, or are they sexually involved?
Admittedly, by both, no platonic relationship.
It is a platonic relationship?
As they phrase it, yes.
Well, do you have reason to believe they're telling the truth?
Yes.
Let me put it this way. Do you have any reason to believe they're not telling the truth? It'd probably be better.
No reason to believe they're not telling the truth.
Well, I don't think it should be disciplined because it's not a sin. I don't know that it's smart. I don't know that it looks good. I think the counsel should be otherwise. But, you know, sometimes people say, well, there shouldn't be any appearance of evil. Well, nowadays, that's not exactly an appearance of evil. I mean, people don't just automatically assume because friends are living together that they're sleeping together. This may sound controversial to some people, but you discipline egregious sin. That's what discipline is, where discipline is required, egregious sin. That means weighty matters. Discipleship deals with some of the smaller things, but church discipline is to deal with the bigger things. If these people were in a discipleship relationship, I'd say this isn't a good idea. It doesn't look good, although it doesn't look as bad as it used to look. And it does set people up for a moral compromise, depending on the nature of the relationship. But I've had friends that have just cohabited. I mean, you got roommates, and one of the roommates is a girl, and she's just living there. And she's paying rent and playing her part or whatever, and there's no problem. There's no other sin that's in view. And I don't think the circumstance itself is a sin, unless you can identify what the moral impropriety would be. And usually people say, well, it's an appearance of evil. Well, I don't know that it is entirely. It might be, but I mean, I think you got a point there, but I don't think that it's a good enough point to get heavy-handed about this.
Right, and I cannot point to any specifics where it appears that something is out of line, other than possibly a little bit of maybe too much emotional attachment, but nothing major. So I can't point to anything.
Well, wait a minute. What would be out of line about being too much emotional attachment? I'm not sure I understand that. Like they're really attached to each other?
Right, like it's more than just a platonic, that there's some deeper emotional.
Okay, but there's nothing untoward about that.
True. I as you put it, that's probably not. I've talked to several, I feel good, Christian people about this, and I was coming from the viewpoint that it was a sin.
Yeah, I don't see that it is.
Scripture, but it just seemed that way to me, and I realized we're not supposed to go on our feelings. And so I counseled, and every person I talked to had basically the same take. Well, you know, this isn't a sin. We don't think it's a real good testimony.
Yeah,
in fact, the couple themselves had, it's like when I see two people walk out of a house, there's the assumption, a man and a woman, that they're probably married, although mm-hmm. today maybe that's not true, but
or that they're sexually involved. But you know, if people that are their neighbors, they know the circumstances a little bit, then they know otherwise. Maybe I don't know. So
right, they did say that they had gone to the neighbors, understanding possibly the issues and explained the situation. So.
Okay, let me just I'll put it as simply as I know how. I'm not comfortable with this issue. I mean, with this situation, and I think that the wisdom says that it's not a good situation. However, being comfortable with it doesn't make it an being uncomfortable with it doesn't make it an, or even being unwise doesn't make it an issue that requires church discipline.
So you're saying the church should not. Your feeling is the church should not address it at all. It's just basically.
No, I guarantee you there.
The point of saying, well, this maybe isn't the best testimony.
No, you might say that to them. I don't
right,
see.
Okay,
when you say the church, usually it's a corporate action.
Right.
And I don't think a corporate action is necessary here. But, I mean, I'm on record as saying I'm not comfortable with it. I don't think it's good and whatever. I've counseled people against it for the reasons I've offered you, but I would discipline it.
I understand.
I guarantee you, though, if your church is of any size, there are people that are living together, cohabiting sexually together, and those people should receive some attention.
Sure.
Not these guys.
Absolutely.
All righty?
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, Joe, I appreciate the call. Time to go to break. I'll come back for my final calls. When I do, I'm Greg Kokel with Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
The dictionary defines the word expand this way: a verb, to open up, to unfold, to increase the extent, number, volume, or scope of. Stand to Reason's focus in 2007 is expanding horizons, a goal born out of our desire to increase your understanding of what it means to be Christ's ambassador, and to open up the riches of truth in new ways, and explore new ways to be more effective as an ambassador for Christ. No conference is better at doing that than our annual Master Series in Christian Thought. This year's lineup of speakers will challenge you to expand your horizons as you face the pressures of being a Christian in today's world. These extraordinary minds will broaden and deepen your understanding of truth amidst an antagonistic and divisive culture. Never has the need been greater for Christians who confidently and competently defend what they believe. You can order the lectures individually, or even better, you can benefit from the entire series. Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. James Emery White, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, and our own Greg Kokel and Alan Schliemann. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON to order this series that will expand your horizons.
Greg Kokel back with you, Stand to Reason, and had some requests about the Paul Harvey piece. And I apologize, I don't know where I got that. I don't know, somebody might have emailed it to me, or I got it from somewhere. I just thought it was clever. So we don't have a URL. I think the enforcer is going to blog on it, and she's going to try to find the location of that. So if you would like that. I can't really just have it printed out and posted because it's his piece, not ours. So that might be a copyright violation, but what we'll do is we'll see if we can put a link to it, if we can find it, and the enforcer will say something about it in the next couple of days. So check the blog out at str.org and see what she has to say. Let's go to Long Beach and Christian. Is this a person named Christian or a person who is a Christian?
Both.
Both. Okay, Christian the Christian. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you. Well, I've already said I'm a Christian, mm-hmm. and I've had a religious studies background in college, in a secular fashion.
Okay.
I like to read books that have to do with textual criticism, and although I've been aware of a lot of the, you know, arguments and things for a long time, I'm reading a book right now called Misquoting Jesus.
Yeah, Bert Ehrlman, right.
Yeah. And this is a book that has really managed to
shake you up.
Well, not I'm having questions about exactly what parts of the Bible are that we can say this is authentic, this is not something that may or may not be, you know.
Okay, authentic means that it reflects the original. That's what you mean by authentic. That's different from being historically accurate. Those are two different questions.
Okay.
So the Gospel of Judas that was uncovered recently,
right,
is an authentic Gospel of Judas. That means it looks like it is the same. It accurately records what the, insofar as we have the, and we only have pieces of it, but what we have is accurate. It's an accurate depiction or copy of the original that was floating around in the second century. It doesn't mean the history, that which is recorded in it, is accurate. It's just that the document is accurate. It's authentic. It's a real example of the so-called Gospel of Judas, which gospel is of questionable accuracy. Does that make it? It's an authentic – well, my take would be it's an authentic example of a false writing.
Okay.
All right? I'm using this illustration of Judas to just indicate that there is a difference between a thing being authentic and a thing being – historically accurate or sound in its content. Now, I think the Gospels are both that the writings that we have now representing the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament are authentic. That is, they accurately represent what was originally written, and I also believe that what was originally written was sound, accurate to the history of the time insofar as those writings touch the history, and accurate theologically too. But those are two different kinds of questions, theological and historical. Brett Ehrlman doesn't think that the documents that we have are authentic, or there's some question about their Bart Ehrman, that they're
as he says in the book, you know, what we have are copies of copies of copies of copies.
Yes.
And that they differ wildly in what they agree on and what they don't agree on.
This is false. They don't differ. Did you say widely or wildly? Actually, neither would apply.
Okay.
There are differences. The vast majority of the differences are spelling differences. Are spelling differences consequential? No. There are some wording differences. The question is whether the wording differences are consequential to the meaning. In most cases, they aren't. There are a few famous differences. One would be the long ending of Mark. And in my Bible, it says right in the margin, most manuscripts don't contain this section. John chapter 8, the end of chapter 7, and the beginning of chapter 8, the woman caught in adultery, says the same thing. There is no theology that hinges on either passage, by the way, that's relevant to Christianity. In fact, this discipline of textual criticism is something that's been in play for a long time, and it's highly sophisticated, and the New Testament represents documents that far and away outstrip anything else available from antiquity in order for us to know what actually happened. In other words, if the New Testament documents are dismissed as not being authentic enough for us to know what actually was written, then nothing from antiquity, by the way, including Shakespeare, which has a much larger level of corruption than any New Testament document, nothing from the past could be accepted based on the same standards. Now, the fact is, we think we know some things about ancient history, even though the documentation we received is less than perfect. And there's a comparison project that goes on with the existing copies. Do you know anything about the existing copies in the New Testament?
Like what?
5,366 portions of the New Testament in existence in our hands today. We have full codices that go back to the 3rd century. We have Codex Vaticanus. We have Codex Sinaiticus. We have Codex Sinai, Vatican, Alexandrinus. We have portions that go back even further. That's the 4th century. We have portions that go back even 3rd, 2nd century. We have a piece of the John Ryland Papyri that's a section, a very small section of the Gospel of John that goes back to the early 2nd century, 125. Now, the reason I'm pointing this out is that we have lots of copies of stuff to do comparisons with. And the stuff we have is really old. It gets very close to the original. This is not like anything else in antiquity. We have more than anybody. And not only do we have 5,366 portions of the New Testament, not whole New Testaments, but some whole New Testaments, but portions of it that we can do comparisons with, but we also have the patristic quotations. Tens of thousands of patristic quotations. In fact, matter of fact, this is where the early church fathers quoted from the Bible. And this provides another, in their writings, and this provides another cross-check for us. We have thousands of translations, the Vulgate, the Coptic, the Syriac. These are translations of the New Testament that we can make comparison with their translation, but there's still another way of testing against the original. We have no good reason to believe that we don't have the New Testament that was written, is the point that I'm making, because there's dozens and dozens of cross-checks. There may be still some things that are still in question, but not much. And those things that are in question are irrelevant to the big picture, theological picture. That's why I feel utterly confident in saying that it is not the case that these manuscripts are wildly different. They're not. Do you have a King James Bible? Do you ever read it?
Yes.
King James Bible is drawn from a certain text family, largely the majority text or the Byzantine text family. A family is a whole group of ancient texts that have the same differences from another group of texts. You know the copy differences? And yet you can read the King James Bible that comes from that, or you can read the New American Standard that's based on kind of another tradition, textual tradition. You're going to see these are basically the same thing. A couple little words, apart from the these and thous and that kind of stuff. In terms of the content, it's basically the same thing. The differences are really very, very small. They don't amount to much theologically. So the complaint that is being raised now by people like Bart Ehrman is not substantive. It doesn't make any difference. I hear silence.
Well, I was listening, and I would do you have maybe a couple books that I can read that would show me the other side? That would
The New Testament documents, are they reliable? Is one book? And that's by F.F. Bruce. That gives you some information. There's also another book called by Norm Geisler. It's called A Basic Introduction to the Bible. And it deals with a lot of those textual questions. It has a whole bunch of stuff in it, but that's another one. You know, Bart Ehrman himself has been responded to by a number of people, and what I would do is I'd Google his name and his book title and see what else you come up with. Because I've read articles and stuff. I haven't read this book myself. I need to. But where there's been a lot of response to it. I wouldn't be surprised if who's the guy from Dallas – Melinda, the guy from Dallas Seminary who did the stuff my mind's going blank here. Darrell Bach. I would be surprised if Darrell Bach hasn't written on this too. B-O-C-K.
Yes, actually, that was when I did Google
And go to the Standard Reasons website, str.org, and then look up Da Vinci Code. That's what I was trying to think of a moment ago, Da Vinci Code. Look up Da Vinci Code. I've written a whole solid ground in which I talk about how Dan Brown got it wrong and why, what the historical information is. So here's a kind of a thumbnail sketch that'll give you some textual information as well. All right?
Yeah. What was the book by F.F. Bruce? I have
New Testament. It's called The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? Okay? I got to run. I got another caller, but give it a shot there, and we'll talk again. Eric, is that Torrance? Yes, Eric.
Yes.
Welcome to Standard Reason, Eric.
Thanks, Greg. I was reading Exodus chapter 4, and the context of which is where God is telling Moses to go down to Egypt and to free his people and confront the Pharaoh. But then suddenly on verse 24.
This is Exodus what?
Chapter 4,
okay.
Verse 24.
Okay.
Then suddenly on the way to Egypt, it looks like God or the Lord is going to kill Moses before he even gets there.
Right.
And that's throwing me off on a loop there. I'm trying to...
Did you keep reading?
No, I didn't.
It's always a good idea to keep reading.
Okay.
What happens next is his wife... came about at the lodging place in the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. And he said, "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone. At that time, she said, "You are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision."
Was it because of Moses didn't circumcise?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
But, you know, this is a mysterious – I'm looking at it myself. I've wondered about this one myself. Sometimes you have these statements in here of what happened, and it takes a smarter man than me to figure out all that's going on, because you understand a lot of the historical background and the cultural background and these kinds of things. And I've read through that and said, that's interesting, scratched my head, and then kept going.
Oh, I see.
I've never done the research on it myself.
Oh.
But there are times when God gets really mad at his people, even his leaders.
Wow.
And they're in trouble.
Yeah.
And so something has to be done to appease that. And in this case, it was circumcision, but this is before. Let me just think here for a second. This is before the command of circumcision is given, I think, for the nation of Israel.
Right.
So I don't. Oh, wait a minute. No, I think. Yeah, that's right. That's in. I think that's right. I don't know. So I don't know what's going on here. I'd love to be able to give you an answer, but, you know, it's just one of those things where Kokel's coming up blank.
Oh, I see.
It's just a curiosity, I'm sure, to you, too.
Well, I'll look into it even further. Then.
Yeah, and the key here is start in chapter 4, in the beginning of chapter 4, and read to the end of the chapter, and make sure that there's not some other piece of information. Sometimes I even have a little handwritten note here that helps me out with some of these tricky things, but I don't even have that here.
Okay.
So I guess I just didn't care enough to find out about it, but I know somebody's probably written about it.
All righty.
Okay, I appreciate your call.
That's all right, great.
Okay, Eric. And I got a few more moments here before the end of the show, and I want to kind of go back just a moment to this conversation about the textual criticism. Oh, that's it. I guess we're out of it. Perfect timing. Saved by the bell. All right, friends. I'll talk with you more next week. I've enjoyed chatting with you today. And in the meantime, please be good ambassadors for Christ if you're followers for Christ. And go out and give them heaven, all right? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.